I'd like to take your Bibles and open to the book of Haggai. We'll be looking at that minor prophet in just a moment. It's a small book, so it may take you a little while to find it. I'll give you a minute or two. Good to have the Hickersons and Stars safely back with us after their travels. Very much appreciate the safety God has blessed them with. It's been an unusual day in a number of ways. This morning, first thing I did, I took my flash drive, dropped the lid, and it rolled underneath the podium. Well, I noticed it has some screws here that I could probably unscrew it and get it out, but I told Randy about it, and he just lifted from the other end and pulled it right out, and so it was safe. And so there was a disaster that was averted. And then my Bears lost today with 1 second left on the clock, but Jerry said in Bible class this morning that sports games don't mean anything, so don't worry about that. And so I feel better about that. Had a wonderful lunch with April and Tim Starr at their house. She's a good spaghetti cooker, if anyone wants to know. Might check into that sometime. And just been a wonderful day and all around, especially good to be with you, to worship God and consider the things that He would have us to do. Appreciate so much the prayer of Ty on behalf of all of us, and hope that things will go well with our nation, with the upcoming election, and in all things that we will seek to do God's will, not only in our personal lives, our public lives, as well as in the lives we have as citizens of this great country in which we live. We're going to talk about Haggai for just a few minutes. Give you a little background of the story coming up to this. Cyrus, the king of Persia, had come to power, and he had desired that the Jews who were in Babylonian captivity could return home and rebuild the temple if that was their desire to do so. And this was in 536 B.C. And so a number of Jews return home and start building the temple. Foundation is laid. Ezra chapter 3 verse 6 starts talking about that. And as the foundation is being laid and the plans are being made to complete the temple, a new king comes to power. And the temple building is halted because of a king named Ahasuerus. And what had happened, the enemies of the Jews didn't like them rebuilding this temple, and they were just looking for some opportunity where they might stop them. Well, this new king comes to power, and they write him a letter and say, "These are very rebellious people. You check the records, look into the chronicles, and you'll see all the times that they were causing trouble and fighting and so on, and you recognize you don't want to give these people any kind of power or foothold. And so don't let them keep on building this thing." And so he went and checked the records, and indeed, the Jews had a good, long reputation of being a rebellious people that liked to fight a lot, as they opposed so many of the nations in the past. And so he gives the order, no more building on that. And it stops. Well, that's the point at which Haggai comes into the picture. And God communicates with Haggai some point after this, about 520 B.C., and tells him it's time. We need to get that temple built. And we're going to be looking at that in just a moment. And so Haggai encourages the people. They start building on it. And there's a new king that's in power at this time, Darius. And he is written to by the Jews. And they write to him and say, "Now if you check the records, you'll see that Cyrus ordered us to build this temple. We're not doing this out of rebellion, but we're doing this because the king told us to." And so he checks the records and verifies that indeed King Cyrus did authorize them to build the temple. And so he says, "You're not going to get any conflict from me. Go ahead." And they complete the temple. It gets done at 516 B.C., so about 20 years in the building process, about 16 years waiting for it to get done. Now, Haggai is one of the three post-exile prophets, which means he's one of the prophets who wrote after the Babylonian captivity. Zechariah is the same time period as Haggai, and he's actually involved in encouraging the rebuilding of the temple as well. And Malachi, being the other one, comes a little bit later. A time that when the Jews had kind of gotten a little more relaxed in things, a little more comfortable with things, and decided that we really don't need to worship God as strictly and as forcefully as we did before. And so they started developing different problems by his time. But here we are with Haggai. We like to look at him. I hope you found the book by now. And first thing we want to talk about with Haggai is something that I think relates to all of us, and that's really the point we want to take when we look at the minor prophets or any other book of the Bible. Where does it fit in our lives? Is there something we're supposed to be doing about it? Is there something that's being taught us? And of course, that's what we always want to do. Take the Bible and focus upon ourselves and see, how can I change? How can I improve? What does God desire of me? And so we start with the idea of wrong priorities. What really comes first in our life? And the people had the concept in their mind that the first thing that needs to be taken care of is my own self. I've got to build my house, and I've got to plant my crops, and I've got to make my profits. And when I get enough money, when I get enough comfort, when I get things set as I want them set, then I will start to serve God. That was the idea of their priorities, the way things were supposed to be done. And you know, there's a great many people having that idea today, isn't there? That I'll be studying the Bible after I get done with my overtime. And I'll come to church after I get done with my vacation. And I might become a Christian sometime later on, and it's just everything gets put off until they do what they want to do. We begin in verse 1, the book of Haggai. It says, "In the second year of Darius, the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, This people say, The time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. In other words, we should not build the temple yet. It's not time for that. What it's time for, it's time for us to plant our crops and to build our houses and take care of our things. We need to take care of our matters first. But the word comes to Haggai the prophet, verse 3 says, And God asked the question, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house, referring to the temple, lie waste? Is it the right thing for us to make sure everything in our life is in order, and when we get everything the way we want it to be, then we can give God some attention? Probably some meager amount of attention by that point. But is that really what it's saying? Should God be the one who's given what we have to give afterwards, after our things are taken care of? He tells them in verse 5, consider your ways. Notice what he says in verse 6. Ye have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but you are not filled with drink. Ye clothed you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put in a bag with holes. What is he telling them? As long as you're focusing on you as number one, you are never going to prosper. That's what he's telling them. You keep working hard. You keep bringing in your crops. You keep doing everything you want to do to make yourself advance, and it keeps falling backwards on you. What's going wrong? You have not put me first. That's what's going wrong. God has to be put in a position of priority. And when he's put in a position of priority, then he will give the blessings that these people are seeking to have in their own life. The word consider is found four times in this short book. It's only two chapters long. In verse 5, he first says, Now therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Think about what you're doing, putting yourself as number one and putting God as number two, only to be dealt with after you get all that you want. He said, consider this. He again says it in verse 7, consider your ways. The word consider comes from three Hebrew words. One means to put, another means upon, and another means the heart. The idea of considering then is to put something upon your heart. To take something into you and give it some serious consideration. Think about this. And a lot of times we don't like to do that. You know, we struggle sometimes with guilt. We're made uncomfortable with something we've done. And we just kind of try to push that thing out of our mind or push it to the back burner. And don't really like to think about that thing. And he's saying, you got to consider this. You got to think about this. Why are things so bad? Should we be blaming God for it? And that's basically what you're doing when you say, God, I'm not going to give anything to you until I get everything I want. And God, you want me to be blessed? Well, you give me everything first, and then I'll see what I can do about serving you. And if I never get around to serving you, it's your fault because you didn't bless me. That's the wrong way. You serve God first, and then He blesses you later. That's His system. That's His way. That's the way it has to be. But consider, why are things so bad? Why is it we keep working hard and we can't seem to get ahead? Why is it that every time I save a few dollars, some other bill shows up that takes them all away from me? Why is that? Could it be that you've not given God the attention He deserves? And he also says, consider in chapter 2, verse 15 and in verse 18. And in those two sections, he's talking about consider, lay it upon your mind, the day. And what he's dealing with is the day of change that's going to take place. When you start doing God's will, then look, from that day forward, things worked out well in our lives. He wants them to recognize that when they start considering why things are so good, that they don't credit themselves for it. You know why? I worked for years trying to grow a large crop and never could quite get it. But then we went and built the temple of the Lord, and I went back and I was just producing wonderful things. And I guess building that temple really taught me something. And no, it's not me. It's God. We did what God wanted to do, and now God is blessing us for all the things we've done. He has to be given first priority. He has to be given that position, and we need to think in order to do that. In Romans, the 12th chapter, a passage that was read in our Bible class this morning, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, the Apostle Paul writes, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service." You give yourself to God first, he says. You present your bodies as a living sacrifice dedicated to God. And he says, "And be not conformed to this world." What's that? Well, that's our priorities. That's what I want. That's my crops and my house and all those things. I want everything in my life first. Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed. How? By the renewing of our minds. By learning to think differently. Thinking spiritual things instead of about the physical things that dominate our minds so much. In Isaiah 1 and in verse 18, God says, "Come, let us reason together." He wants us to use our mind. He wants us to consider. He wants us to think. Because that is part of what is necessary in order to be right with God. Things have to be put upon our heart for us to ever be right with God. And in Proverbs 23 and verse 7, we're told, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Whatever it is we're thinking, whatever it is we're considering, whatever it is that's dominating our attention, that's what we are. And God wants that to be Him. He wants us to give Him number one priority. Well, there's another thing we can talk about. And that is, very often we have the wrong concept of glory. We get a little mixed up in our minds sometimes. You think, Michael Jordan, now he was glorious. No. Oh, I think this car is glorious. No, that's not it. So much money, Bill Gates, whatever. People have all these ideas in their minds about what really is glorious. And we get discouraged because we have the wrong concept of what really involves glory. And we've got to recognize that and make changes. Now, godly men get discouraged. Just because you're godly doesn't mean the world never touches you. Things never go wrong in your life. Everything's always wonderful. No, things are going to go wrong in your life even if you're a godly person. In Ezra chapter 3, verses 2 and 8, it speaks of Zerubbabel and Joshua and how these individuals got involved in building the temple. They laid the foundation, but then the great discouragement came. The order from the king, you stop building that and you stop it right now. And so they stopped at the order of King Ahasuerus. And they were discouraged about that. Now, they couldn't do what it is they wanted to do for the Lord. And then in Haggai 1:1, we're told that God speaks to this prophet, and he speaks to these two leaders of the people saying, you know, we've got to get busy doing the thing that God wants us to do. We want this thing built. In verse 12, we read of chapter 1, "Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord their God, and the words of the prophet Haggai, as the Lord their God had sent them, and the people did fear before the Lord." Verse 14 says, "And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel." These people not only got busy doing the building of the temple, they got excited about building the temple. And the reason, in verse 13, is because God says, "I am with you, saith the Lord." What is the thing that caused us to be destroyed by the Babylonians? What caused us to be carted away into captivity? What caused us to cease building on the temple before? The fact that they never knew if God was going to protect them or not. They were scared of their enemies. They've been conquered. They've been humiliated. But if God is with us, we don't have to worry about anybody else. It doesn't matter what any of the kings say or any of the armies do. If God is with us, we're going to be fine. And so they got excited about building it, and they got busy doing that. In chapter 2 of the book, beginning at verse 20, There's one more message from Haggai. He's speaking to Zerubbabel again, the governor. And he's talking to him in what I would consider to be symbolic language, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth. Now, this is not talking about God is literally going to vibrate the planets. But rather, God is going to bring about some tremendous, magnificent thing. And he says later on in verse 23 that Zerubbabel is going to be a signet. What he's telling him, and I think we wouldn't recognize it unless we knew the New Testament, is the fact that Zerubbabel is going to be an ancestor of Jesus Christ. And that's glory, friends. There's nothing more glorious in your life than you could be connected with Jesus. Well, when the foundation was first laid in Ezra chapter 3, verses 10 through 13, there were a number of people there that were old enough to have seen Solomon's temple. And it was a tremendous thing. It was big and it was beautiful and it had gold and jewels all over it. And it was spectacular. Well, of course, it got destroyed. It got leveled. It got totally torn apart. And as the foundation was laid for the new temple, these older people immediately recognized, this isn't going to compare to Solomon's temple in glory. This isn't going to be anything like that. Well, I think Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, is talking about the later time when they start working on the foundation again. But verse 3 says, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? The first time they laid the foundation, several of these priests were crying because it was such a mess. This isn't going to be anything like Solomon's temple. We're never going to attain the glory we once had as God's people. And they were very discouraged about it, and so it is here that he puts forth the idea. But you know, the new temple is going to have more glory than the old one. This new temple is going to have more glory than Solomon's had. Well, how can that be? He goes on to talk about this beginning in verse 4 of chapter 2, telling them how it's going to have glory. Let's go up to verse 7 where he says, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations will come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. When do you think that happened? My judgment would be in John, the second chapter, verse 14 through 21, as Jesus Christ walked into that temple. That's glory. God Himself physically inside that temple. Solomon never had anything like that. He never got close to that. All that gold wasn't that precious. All of the great ornate structures and architectures and designs and the veil and all the beauty of it did not compare to God Himself walking in to that temple. And when Jesus walked in, you know what He did. He threw out everybody that was in there, selling all kinds of things they shouldn't have been selling and doing all kinds of business they shouldn't have been involved in. But the point we need to see is, where is true glory? It's not in the money. It's not in the architecture. It's not in what other people think is, oh, that's valuable, that's precious. It's in Jesus. And our relationship with Jesus. That's where true glory is to be found, and that needs to be the thing that we're seeking after in the life that we have. The third thing we want to talk about is the wrong concept of holiness. And we've talked about this in previous lessons. How a question is put forth to the priest. Again, God speaks to Haggai the prophet and says, I want you to put forth a question to the priest. And so he asks them a question. And that question has to deal with holiness. In chapter 2, verse 12, he says, if one bear holy flesh in his skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, no. What they're saying is, because something's holy and it bumps something else, it doesn't make that something else holy. Holiness is not contagious. And that's the question they were asked, and that was the answer they gave, and it was the right answer. And they needed to hear this because many of the Jews had the idea that somehow brushing up against a certain situation made them holy. Because I was born a Jew, that makes me acceptable in God's sight. That makes me righteous. That makes me wonderful. No, it doesn't. Because I live in Jerusalem, the city of God. Nothing's ever going to happen to me. I'm always going to be protected. I'm always going to be provided for. No, you're not. Because I'm close to the temple and I worship there. Everything's going to be fine in my life. God is going to provide for me. No. The Jews were killed. The city was destroyed. The temple was leveled. Why? Because they didn't have holiness. because they thought they got it by touching somebody else, by being in a certain family, by being in a certain place. And they had to realize that is not where holiness is to be found. And you've got to get rid of that idea from your mind if you're ever going to be holy. It's going to take personal purification in order to be holy. You're going to have to do what God said needs to be done in order to become holy. Whether it be circumcision when you're a baby, or going through the ceremonial process that the priest is supposed to go through, or being baptized to become a New Testament Christian, whatever God says needs to be done, you're going to have to personally be responsible and do that in order to receive the status of being holy with God. Well, then there's another question put forth, and that's, the question is uncleanness, the opposite of holiness, is that contagious? Verse 13. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these things, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, it shall be unclean. So the answer is uncleanness contagious? Yes, it is. If you are defiled and you touch something else, that something else becomes defiled as well. And that something else, as well as you, are going to have to go through the right personal purification ceremony in order to become clean again. So what he's telling us is that a defiled man cannot offer a holy sacrifice. As I take hold of the animal, and it has no spot, no blemish, and it's 1 year old, just the qualifications that God asked for, and I take this over to the priest and say, I want you to offer this, but I myself am contaminated. I am wicked. I'm just doing it for show. That sacrifice can't be holy. It can't be used to purify anything in me because I'm not purifying myself. I've got to want to change myself. I've got to get my heart right before I offer this sacrifice to God. And so obedience is always going to bring the reward that we want from God. And God goes on to talk about this through the prophet Haggai. In the latter verses of the second chapter, how if this people were to purify themselves, if they were to get right with me, then they could start considering the days from the time they straighten themselves out and looking at their prosperity and the blessings that are going to be theirs. So three points we'll sum up real quickly. Number one, wrong priorities. People get the idea we need to obey God after we do what we want to do and after we take care of our own personal needs. That's not true. We need to obey God first and then He will bless us. Get our priorities in order. Get things right. Do what God would have us to do, and then God will bless us. The second idea, the wrong ideas of glory. We need to recognize that glory is something that is spiritual. It surpasses the physical glory. And we'll look at somebody's magnificent house and think, oh, I wish I had a house like that, or somebody's fancy car. I wish I had something like that. And we start getting all caught up in these physical things, and what we need to do is we need to recognize the spiritual things are where glory really is to be found. I've probably told you this story before. There was a young man who wanted to learn to be a preacher. And I was, of course, the older guy. Always, I'm the older guy. And I was trying to teach this guy to preach, and I took him with me to a class of a bunch of preachers. And we got together, and we discussed a religious subject, and as we were driving on the way home, I asked this young man, what did you think of the class? And he said, well, I guess it was all right. I really didn't think the teacher was that good, and I really didn't think the subject was that good. I didn't think it was handled just right. And he just had all kinds of criticisms of what went on in our class. And here's a guy, 17 years old, wanting to become a preacher, telling all these older guys, telling me only face-to-face, but talking about all these older people, how they're just really not doing what they ought to be doing. They're just really not as good as they ought to be. And as we're driving along, I told him, now Jim, you need to understand something. There is a spiritual side of life that needs to be focused on. And there are physical things that need to be laid aside and not concentrated on. Do you understand what I'm saying? He goes, wow, did you see that Mustang? And I said, never mind. He didn't get it. He was looking at the glory of an automobile. He was looking at the glory of this physical world and could not come to see that the spiritual things had any value. We've got to get past that thinking in our mind. We have the wrong idea of glory far too many times and need to understand where it is found. It is found in Jesus Christ. And the closest you and I are ever going to get to glory in this life is to be a servant of Jesus Christ. And that's something we ought to be shooting for and trying to accomplish. And finally, the wrong concept of holiness. It is not obtained by casual affiliation with other holy things or other holy people. There are so many people who have the idea in their mind that I'm saved because I'm a member of the Church of Christ. You're saved because you're a Christian. Because you're a servant of Jesus Christ. That's why you're saved. And because your name is on a church roster, and because you assemble with other religious people, it doesn't mean you're holy. How many people gather together Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, but never have worshiped? But rather they just show up to rub elbows with holy people. It doesn't rub off, folks. It's not there. You're not going to become holy by affiliating with holy people. You're going to have to make the personal commitment. You're going to have to really worship God yourself. You're going to have to truly get involved. You're going to have to consider, lay upon your heart, God and the things He says that you're supposed to do with your life. It's been said many times in the denominational field, and that's why I don't like to use the terminology, but it's true, that you have to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. When people in the denomination say that, they're talking about some kind of feeling that you have, and that's not at all what it is. A personal relationship with Jesus Christ means that you submit your will to Him. That you recognize what He teaches in the Bible. You follow what He says in the Bible. That will have an effect on your heart. But it's not purely heartfelt with no intellect being involved. We need to get our minds involved, our minds active in regard to serving God. If you're here this evening and you're not a Christian, there's no finer time than right now to get that right. Remember we started talking about priorities. And how easy it is to say, well, I'll become a Christian after I do. Don't. Don't do something before you become a Christian. If you know what you're supposed to do, you need to do it right now. If you don't know what you're supposed to do, then right now you need to find out. You need to study. You need to talk to somebody about, what's it take for me to get right with God? What does He require of me? You get hold of somebody and say, I want to know right now, this evening, I want to become aware. But we had a class this morning on counting the cost. Considering the investment of your life as being made in being Christian. You know, part of the problem we have is we don't want to consider the cost. We don't even want to let that enter into our mind. I don't want to think about sacrificing anything or giving anything up or doing without anything. And so I'll just put Christianity off on the back burner and do the things I want to do. Well, you need to get rid of that thinking. You need to start considering, why is it you're not prospering? Why is it you're not benefiting? Why is it your life's not the way it ought to be? Why is it you're not going to heaven? Because you keep telling God, I'll get to you later. And God will not be put off. If you know what it takes to be a Christian, you need to become one right now. If you don't know what it takes to be a Christian, you need to find somebody in this assembly who can teach you right now. And get yourself right with Him and put nothing on hold in regard to your spiritual condition. Now, if we can help you to become a Christian, we'd love to assist you at this opportunity. If you are a Christian and found that you've been pushing God back and you've decided some other things take priority in your life and you need to make a reversal of that, you need to repent of those sins. If we can help you in any way, come right now while we stand and while we sing the song selected.